India was the romantic literary muse of the famous 19th century English writer Rudyard Kipling. Out of this romance came his most famous book, Kim, whose central character is an English boy disguised as an Indian, who spies for his British masters against Russian designs to conquer India. This was a tale of imperialism, knowledge, and power that gave universal recognition to the term Great Game and also endowed the British Raj's intelligence service and its map makers with an adventurous mystique in their shadowy game of domination with the Russian Empire in 19th century Central Asia.
Welcome, friends. James Corbett here, CorbettReport.com. Today is the 14th of November, 2013, and this is another edition of Film Literature and the New World Order, that series where on a monthly basis we're exploring different works of literature and or cinema and their relevance to the social and political and economic and other information that we talk about on a regular basis at CorbettReport.com. So for those of you who are familiar with this series, you will know that it generally comes out on the third Monday of each month. But that was disrupted last month because my family was visiting, so I didn't have a chance to get this recorded and done. And this month I'm going to be in France on the third Monday. That will be next Monday. So I am recording it now with our good friend David L. Smith, who has been kind enough to review Kim by Rudyard Kipling and to comment on it with me today. So first of all, David, thank you very much for your time today. And thank you for doing this on very short notice. I only mentioned it after we recorded our last interview, so I know that you didn't have a lot of time to go through it, but you did, I believe, listen to the audiobook version of this?
Yes, indeed. I listened to the audiobook, which is extremely good. It is quite lengthy, and you do get a slightly different impression of a book by listening to the audio compared to reading it. But it is nonetheless, it's a remarkable story. It's the story of a young boy, an orphan boy in India, whose father belonged to an army regiment, and he lives for a number of years in the streets in India. as a beggar boy, knowing all of the local scene and situation, and he is eventually rediscovered by the army, who realizes he's a very smart kid, and also he ends up back in the unit where his father had at one time served. And little by little, his life changes because he also meets a lama who is on a mission to discover a river which is meant to bring peace and tranquility to the rest of his life. And the two become befriended, and the young boy's life is torn between the life with the lama of wandering and exploring and quite spiritual, and the world of the army. And the world of the army leads him towards, in particular, the world of spying, because at that particular time there are a lot of rivalries between the British Empire and the neighboring countries, Afghanistan, and of course the influence of Russia behind it. So it turns into from spirituality into a kind of a detective story, into a kind of divided loyalty between the two families that the boys brought up with them, the British Raj military spying complex, if you like, and the spiritual world of the Lama. And the end of the book, you're still left to some degree in doubt as to which side of the camp he has actually picked, but he lives a fascinating life between the two. So the author of the book is Rudyard Kipling. He was one of the first people, actually, when the Nobel Peace Prize, not the Nobel Peace Prize came out, the Nobel Prizes came out, he was one of the first people to earn a prize for literature, and he was also the youngest person to receive a prize for literature. And I have to say, I can see why. Anyone who's ever tried to write a book, or write particularly one with a historical background or a deep contextual element to it, realizes how much research that you have to do, or how many hours of research you have to do to write one page. And he has got something which is almost four-dimensional in what he is writing about. He's writing about India, the British approach, the neighboring influences like Pakistan, and then all of the social skills within the country. And I think he does it remarkably well, very convincingly for me. And I'm not surprised that this book was a bestseller and is regarded by many, many people as the summit of his writing skills. So there we are.
Well, that is, yes, an excellent summary, and that is a good launching point for the conversation, because as you say, it was certainly well-received by many people at the time, and it was widely recognized as a great book. In fact, on theatlantic.com, you can find a review that was written in December of 1901 that starts out by saying, quote, "There is a fine antidote to all manner of morbidness in the brilliant pages of Kim. Mr. Kipling's last work, at the time, is, to my mind, his best, and not easily comparable with the work of any other man, for it is of its own kind, and of a novel kind, and fairly amazes one by the proof it affords of the author's magnificent versatility. Not much of a story may perhaps be the verdict of the ruthless boy reader who revels in The Jungle Book and Captain Courageous, and derives an unholy gratification from Stocky and Co. Kim is, in fact and upon the surface, but an insignificant fragment of human history, a bit out of the biography of a little vagabond of Irish parentage, orphaned when a baby and left to shift for himself in infinite India." And it goes on from there, and I will put that link in so you can read that. That's just some of the reception that occurred at the time there in 1901. So I think you're exactly right. Kipling's literary reputation was certainly cemented with Kim, if it hadn't already coalesced at that time with some of his better-known works, The Jungle Book and things of that nature that had already come out at that time. But this was certainly a step upwards in terms of content and depth of exploration of the subject. And I must admit, I, like yourself, was deeply impressed with the versatility and the knowledge and the depth of the exploration that he puts into to his writing of India and all of the various aspects of it and the different castes and all of this that that go into the kind of the portrayal, the representation of this world. However, of course, we know that in recent decades, Kipling and his legacy have been, well, shall we say, challenged by various forces. Of course, the post-colonial school of literary criticism, headed and spearheaded by people like Edward Said, have greatly criticized Kipling for his portrayal, saying it is stereotypical and doesn't show a true understanding of India, etc., etc. But I find, in fact, in the research that I was doing for today, one of the most interesting reviews that I read was actually by George Orwell, who wrote a kind of overarching essay about Rudyard Kipling. And I will, again, refer listeners to that. I'll put the link in. But he has some interesting things to say about Kipling and the line that he straddles between being just a vulgar propagandizer for imperialism and someone who has a somewhat subtler and more complicated understanding of what's happening there. Let's start with an exploration of that subject, because of course this is something that's very much at the heart of the story, is the idea of British imperialist involvement in India and the extent to which that is a good thing. Is it a bad thing? Does it have a mixed legacy? How does Kipling portray it? How did that come across to you, and what was your take on that from the historical perspective that Kipling was writing from?
Well, it's a very good question. I mean, to me, Kipling was a man of his times. I mean, he was writing at the time when the British Raj was at its zenith, at the turn of the 19th to 20th century. He himself had been, I believe, born in India, had spent his early years in India, then went back to be schooled in the UK in fairly tough circumstances. And eventually he came back again to India. His father was basically a professor looking after a museum in, I believe, Lahore. Obviously, you know, in the British colonial environment, they were a fairly tight-knit group, because all in all, in India, there was a population at that time of maybe 50 million people, and there were 500,000 Brits. So if you take out the military aspects of it and the traders, you know, there was a very small British elite who all knew each other, certainly Kipling and his family were part of that elite, and there's even references to them being quite close to the Viceroy of India at the time. So I would suspect, you know, I'd say I'm a lot behind Kipling in terms of generations, but I've seen personally, you know, the end of the British Empire from my aunts and uncles who lived through that time in history as well. And the assumption was that the empire would continue. The assumption was, by and large, that people were there to do good. There were, of course, you know, the the evil exploiters, as there are anyway. And, you know, in Africa, that was characterized by Cecil Rhodes. And some people might say Clive of India was a fairly bad character as well. You know, all of these elements led to, at or around that time, probably a sense of the fact that this is the way the world order should always have been, and it wasn't really to be questioned because the people who were in it were very comfortable in it. And occasionally I found myself looking at it and thinking, well, this is 100 years ago, the version of what the American empire is going through today, that where they think that their abusive hegemony is theirs by God-given right, and when they throw their weight around, then that's only fair because they're the arbiters of everything. So I don't believe, you know, it's very easy to rewrite history in a different context. And were these people, you know, stereotyping? No, I don't think so. And I think that Kipling, you know, he started, as I say, he was born in India. He had a sense of the culture. He went to the UK. He came back. When he came back, he worked as a journalist for a number of years, essentially in the area of India he was writing about. He would certainly have seen the caste system at work and you know, help administer it. So I think for people 100 years later to criticize cynically and say he didn't understand anything, when the people who are making these comments have never even probably been to the country or understood any of it or lived or felt any of it, and they're doing it a kind of ex post facto you know, kind of U.S. view on the world, I think is rather comical.
I tend to agree with that. I think that that is just too easy an assessment to make. And it is interesting, you mentioned, of course, Kipling's connection to Cecil Rhodes, who was his personal friend. And Kipling wrote some lines, a poem for Rhodes' funeral. And I believe that's still in some inscription somewhere or other in Rhodesia as a memorial to Cecil. And that, of course, should be interesting to anyone who follows any of my work, because, of course, they'll know that the Cecil Rhodes was the founder of the Roundtable Group through one of his last wills and testaments, and that has branched out into becoming the Royal Institute of International Affairs / the CFR / the core of groups, international transnational groups that have been fighting for a different type of world order, perhaps, than the one Cecil Rhodes was envisioning specifically, but still something along those lines. So this does have some sort of degree of continuum there. And people who have read Tragedy and Hope and other tomes like that will have an understanding of that. And just on that note, from that particular Orwell essay that I was talking about before, he writes, but how true is it that he, Kipling, was a vulgar flag waver, a sort of publicity agent for Cecil Rhodes? It is true, but it is not true that he was a yes man or a time server. After his early days, if then, he never courted public opinion. Mr. Eliot says that what is held against him is that he expressed unpopular views in a popular style. This narrows the issue by assuming that unpopular means unpopular with the intelligentsia, but it is a fact that Kipling's message was one that the big public did not want, and indeed has never accepted. The mass of the people in the 90s, the 1890s, as now, were anti-militarist, bored by the empire, and only unconsciously patriotic. Kipling's official admirers are and were the service middle class, the people who read Blackwood's. So, again, a very interesting assessment from Orwell talking about that I think fundamental underlying truth. As you point out, it's equally true of the American empire of today that the average person really doesn't feel wonderful about this militarism and bloodshed around the world. That's just the type of patriotic gloss that they put over top of it, and they have the corporate media putting out all the propaganda to make you feel that that's the general sentiment. But I haven't met many of those people in real life anyway, who really are gung-ho about the American imperial project. And I imagine it was probably equally true back in Kipling's time. This was just the official kind of gloss that was put over things and popularized by people like Kipling, who did contribute to that with some of his writings, obviously. Turning to probably one of the core central issues of Kim geopolitically speaking, of course, we're talking about something called the Great Game, which was something that lasted throughout much of the 19th century. And I believe the term was coined by someone different, but it was really popularized and brought into the public consciousness by Kipling in this book, where it is specifically mentioned by name. And the Great Game, as you mentioned before, was the struggle between Russia and Britain for control of Central Asia, which was then, as it is now, seen as kind of the crown jewel in any attempt at anything like a global empire. And, of course, the struggle for states like Afghanistan, or whatever form it was in at the time, really was central in Britain's thinking to its defense of its Indian empire, Indian aspect of its empire, because if Afghanistan fell, I guess it was the domino theory of the 19th century, if Afghanistan fell to the Russians, then they would be able to stage an attack on India. And that was the great concern throughout much of the 19th century, a lot of political intrigue happening. Let's talk about that aspect of the geopolitics that form the background to Kim and really do drive the plot along as he becomes an a spy for the British Army.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, the Great Game, you described it pretty well. I mean, the same game by whatever name is going on today, and it is geopolitical rivalries between the great powers in the world, and we have demonstrations of it all the way through the Middle East. We have demonstrations of it also, you know, between, to some degree, China and Russia. The American intervention or probable attempts at destabilizing, you know, situations in China and Russia by using Islamist extremists as their puppets or whatever else you want to call it. But don't forget, at that time, I mean, Britain was looking fairly secure. I mean, they had Hong Kong, which was completely under their control. It was the Hong Kong, Shanghai. I mean, all of the trade coming out of China was going through these ports, these great cities. You also look at India, where India, Burma, they had tea, they had rubber, they had oil, they basically had their hands in all the resources. And of course, if I were a neighbor looking over at that, I would be unhappy. And if we look at what happened with Japan some 20 or 30 years later, I mean, the fact that they were deprived of the basic raw materials to ensure their own independent survival led in many respects to, you know, the walking out of the League of Nations, their militaristic build-up, and eventually to Pearl Harbor. So all of these things are sort of underlying and going on all of the time, and yes, there was certainly the struggle, the hidden struggle, a covert struggle between Russia and India, and in a large part, I mean, the British, in terms of colonialists, I think were probably smarter than most in that they co-opted the local leadership to work along with them. And that way they managed to control, as I say, you know, 50 million people with 500,000. There was an awful lot of it was done by undercover work and spies and intrigues and payoffs. And it's a bit like Afghanistan today on a bigger scale, you know, where you have one Mr. Karzai who's paid off as, you know, the president of Kabul, paid off as little sub-presidents of other areas. I mean, this is how India was run as well. So, yes, I mean, it would be a fascinating time, and as long as you're spying and outmaneuvering people, you're not actually shooting and killing. And that's part of the success of the British Empire, which ran all the way through basically until after the Second World War, where Britain admitted that that the end of the game had come and basically progressively handed over independence to India in 47 or 49, I can't remember which. And, of course, the French took a different approach and said, well, we're going to hang on to Indochina militarily, and that led to Dien Bien Phu and a massive humiliating defeat for the French and their final withdrawal from basically from the Asian scene altogether. And that left the door open for the War of Vietnam. So I'm all for spying. Put it like that. Spying spills little blood.
And, I mean, it's interesting that Kipling creates in Kim the perfect character for a spy. I mean, this is the template, the blueprint for what you would want, I think, in a spy. Someone who has grown up as an outsider of the outsiders, who was fully Irish by ethnicity, but grew up basically as a native, was able to pass as a native, and yet was familiar, really did straddle both worlds and was familiar with both and had loyalties and allegiances to both, which goes back to that spiritual slash military type divide that we see in the story that you mentioned earlier. And the story of how he comes to be recruited and it all seems quite realistic in the way that it's portrayed at any rate. I think he does, an exceptional job of creating in the character itself, kind of the foundation of the story.
Well, this is very true. I mean, it's rather comical. You know, our model of spies are all kind of James Bond driving around in Aston Martins and dropping into great events out of helicopters. But the reality of spying, I think, on the ground is people like this, people who are very often relatively seedy, whose origins are very mixed, whose allegiances are mixed, because if your allegiances weren't mixed, you wouldn't spy. And then, of course, these people are guided and controlled by the spy masters. And in the UK, for example, the spy masters, you know, if you don't have a first from Cambridge, you can't become a spy master. And if you don't go to the right college, then probably you'll not be on the list either. So the whole thing is a bit comical. And I seriously wonder about how efficient our spying apparatus is, at least in Britain. And I think with the CIA, I mean, very often these people stand out like sore thumbs. You know, Geneva's a city where there's a lot of spying goes on because it's a crossroads of the United Nations, it's a crossroad of business, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, I mean, there are even bars where these people are known to hang out. And you don't need to guess very hard when you see a few bruisers with a sort of bulging jacket pocket beside someone who obviously looks like a Brit who's lost in the middle of Switzerland to have an idea what might be going on. So anyway, yes, all that's true. One thing I was going to mention coming back, that I think it's important to understand about Kipling, is his life was actually quite tragic. And that probably influenced his writing and his views as well. Because he had one child, he had three children, one son, two daughters. And one of his daughters died of pneumonia quite young. And his son was killed in the First World War. And in large measure, the father, who believed in the colonial structure and the struggle between, evil and the fight against Bolshevism and all the rest of it, kind of pushed his son into the war, and he came back in a body bag. And, of course, this led to this enormous tragedy in his life. So when you read some of the things that he's written, I mean, there's one other work that's worth mentioning, a poem which is often criticized called The White Man's Burden. Now, The White Man's Burden, some people interpret it as a cry for colonialism and the merits of colonialism. But at the same time, if you read it with a different view, you can read it very easily and say, well, actually, he says what... He says what colonialism is, but at the same time, he says a terrible price to pay by sending the sons of sons to the empire never to come back, etc., etc. So, Kipling is not here to ask him what he actually thought when he wrote it, but I don't find myself coming down and saying he was a guy who was in any way a believer in colonialism to the point, the point of destroying villages to save them. I don't think so at all.
I kind of take the opposite point there, because I think he was a true believer in it. I think that there are people who have these ideas of imperialism, colonialism, and whatever that are just convenient ideologies as a way of projecting power around the globe and will use that to put the pieces in place in various countries. But I think there are people like Kipling who truly believe in the quest, in the idea, well, we can civilize the world, we can really do this. And I think that he really believed in that ideal and really thought that that's what it was going to inevitably lead to. And I think what in the aftermath of World War One, not only of course the actual price that he paid with his son, but just seeing that despite having been victorious in this great war, England was left even less of a superpower than it was before it. I mean, it was in a weakened state basically geopolitically, and the idea of the British Empire started to wane certainly from that point. So I think he was really devastated on a number of levels from that, and so so we're told that his later works are more somber. I'm not familiar enough with the oeuvre of Kipling to be able to evaluate that, but that certainly makes sense. But of course, what we're talking about with Kim, this came out in 1901, so I think still in his earlier period where he was still more hopeful, more optimistic about the end goal of this imperialist quest.
Yeah. Right. I think a number of politicians from that period, and another one you could cite very easily is politicians and intelligentsia from that period believed in the colonial approach because they, you know, part of it was evangelizing Christianity around the world. Part of it was grabbing empire. My grandfather was a missionary, for example, so he believed in it fervently and sincerely. But you take people like Churchill, it was the same thing. I mean, his belief was fundamentally that, you know, trying to help the natives was actually doing good. And I think quite often it was, sometimes it wasn't. And when you see aberrant countries that emerge like Zimbabwe with the terrible suffering of the people there, or, you know, the post-independence countries like Nigeria with civil wars and millions of people who die, then you have to say, well, was colonialism so bad? Because at no point did these things actually happen at least under British colonialism. And, you know, people hold up Amritsar in India as being one of the, you know, the terrible things that happened where several hundred people were slain. And it is true, there were several hundred people, and it was a terrible thing. But in terms of absolute numbers, I mean, the death toll inflicted by third world leaders on their own population subsequent to independence is hundreds of times more than colonialism ever achieved in its most dark moments.
But the flip side of that argument is saying that, well, those structures that were then abandoned by the British wouldn't have been in place. The society would have evolved in a different way if the imperialism hadn't been there as the template in the first place, and it was the withdrawal that causes the kind of fallout from that, which causes the problem. So, but at any rate, I mean, that's what certain people within the American imperialist superstructure these days would say. Well, we're spreading freedom and democracy, and I'm sure there are people who truly, really believe it as true believers that they really are spreading freedom and democracy at the barrel of a gun. But let's downplay that secondary part of it. So, I mean, these are issues that are very much still with us. So just bring this all back to the present day, because ultimately this is what this series is about, exploring these historical works in the context of what we're talking about here on a weekly basis. As you mentioned, the great game is really still going on, and it's a kind of a new great game, but it's still happening, and it's still, I mean, Russia, Britain are still involved in it, and at any rate, if you look at NATO and Russia, and talking about roughly the same geographical area, and centering on Central Asia and the Central Asian republics, and looking at some of the things that are going on right now in terms of fomenting Islamic terrorism there and all of that. Although I would say that the difference between the great game of the 19th and the 20th century or 21st centuries is that in the 19th century, it was more about actual control of geographical areas. Now it seems to be more about control of the resources and the transportation corridors for those resources, namely the pipelines, which is such a fundamental part of what's going on right now when we're looking at all of these Nabucco and all of these different pipeline deals that are being waged and which countries they'll cut through and who has influence over which country and which terrorists are popping up in what countries to threaten to undermine which government, etc. So it is a different great game, but it's very much similar in terms of course competing for the same geographical locations and figures. So I guess the question is, what, if anything, can we learn about the nature, the form, the potential for the development of this new great game from what Kipling shows us about the old great game of the 19th century?
Boy, that's a heavy question.
And you have 2 minutes to summarize this.
I should do some Buddhist meditation for the next 2 minutes.
get detached from the wheel of life.
Exactly. You know, the rivalries between great powers will be there forever. And as you say, what they actually want to get their hands on, or the way the means they use to get their hands on things become more and more subtle. And if you look at the moment, we're witnessing cyber wars becoming increasingly important, whereas 100 years ago, you were sailing around with huge battleships on the sea, trying to keep the sea lanes open to get your goods back to any particular country. Now we're looking at things where people are, well, for example, if we believe what's said about Iranian nuclear plants, for example, at Stuxnet, the malware that was injected into that managed to cripple the nuclear plant. Now, maybe what we're moving towards is things like you phoning up Japan one day and saying, well, just to let you know, we've introduced Stuxnet into all your nuclear plants in the country, and we'd like you to do the following things as soon as possible, please. So it is becoming more and more subtle, and it's moving more towards the Kim model of, spying, undercover operations, introducing a tiny little software bug into a sophisticated system can create an awful lot more damage than sinking an aircraft carrier in the middle of the sea or attacking Pearl Harbor or whatever else it is. So all of the tricks of the game become much more, it's a much more intellectual game. It's not really a physical game anymore. I mean, a physical game could be the end result of the chain of events, but by and large, I think that is the biggest mutation. It's a technology mutation, but it doesn't really matter. You know, if you read anything from Julius Caesar all the way through to today, you know, people were still killing each other for power and rivalries and expanding empires or contracting empires, etc. So we're in the wheel of life, as they say in the book, and this great wheel changes, but the more it turns around, the more it remains the same.
You know, that is a very good assessment of it, because it really is so true. I mean, all of these intrigues and things, of course, the names, the places, the dates, the figures change, but it's ultimately the same thing happening generation after generation after generation, and really does make you wonder if we will ever be able to escape that and find a different path, a different narrative, a different story, so that we don't have to live through it again and again and again. We should know our history so we're not doomed to repeat it, I guess, would be the apt quotation to bring into mind. Well, on that note, something completely different, I found it interesting that I believe it was in that Orwell essay that he notes some of the phrases, the neologisms that Kipling brought into the English language, which is always something interesting to look at. And of course, some of them we still used in this day and age. Some of them I've never heard before, like East is East and West is West. The White Man's Burden, as you mentioned. What do they know of England who only England know? The female of the species is more deadly than the male. Somewhere east of Suez is apparently one of Kipling's lines, and paying the Dane yelled, which I've never heard that before in my life. So, but anyway, some of the things that Kipling has contributed to the English language, and befitting his status as an illustrious Nobel laureate, I suppose. Although I must admit my taste for the Nobel Prize has been deeply scarred by the Peace Prize recipients of various times, from Nixon on to Obama and all of them. But at any rate, some interesting facts. And of course, as I say, I'll throw in those links to those articles that I was talking about in today's conversation. David Smith, anything else you'd like to say to wrap up our conversation about this book?
No, I think we've done the tour. I'd just give you one last quote from Kipling, which I learned as a kid, which was the poem of Gunga Din. And the story of Gunga Din was he was a servant who was badly treated, and on the battlefield he saved somebody, and in the course of being saved he got killed himself. And the last line of the poem is, "You're a better man than I am, Gunga Din." So the British Empire did have some respect for these people after all.
Very, very interesting. Well, again, I want people to take a look at this for themselves. I certainly hope you've read Kim, if you're listening to this, but if you have, perhaps you can use this as a springboard to explore some of Kipling's other works and perhaps his influence on and influence by people like Cecil Rhodes, and how that redounds through the ages to today, and also how the Great Game is being renewed. And for people who are interested in the new Great Game, as it has been dubbed, there is in fact a regular update, news update series at BoilingFrogsPost.com called The New Great Game Roundup that's put together by Christoph German in Germany, who I interviewed a couple of months back, so you can find my interview with him where we talk about some of the aspects of this new Great Game as it unfolds. So, again, it's basically the same thing happening all over again. All right, David Smith, thank you very much for your time. Once again, of course, people can find you at GenevaBusinessInsider.blogspot.com, and I'm looking forward to talking to you again for our regular Geneva Business Insider conversation next month. But until then, thank you so much for your time.
It's a pleasure. I never thought in my life I'd become a literary critic, but you know, this wonderful world of technology makes all things possible. So thanks very much for inviting me once again on your show on a completely different theme.
All right, folks, there he goes, David L. Smith of Geneva Business Insider, and that's going to do it for today's edition of Film Literature and the New World Order. And generally, I would usually wrap up most of the episodes by sharing some feedback from the previous edition of the podcast, but the last edition, of course, was our conversation with Thomas Sheridan talking about Gaslight, and although it was a popular conversation, there was a lot of positive feedback saying it was a good conversation, and actually, I had one email from one person who really disliked the conversation, but generally, very positive feedback, but not really any specific feedback that I can share or any more insights into the movie itself or the various adaptations of it. So we will forego the usual feedback wrap up today, but I should, of course, announce what will be up next on our plate for Film Literature in the New World Order, and that is going to be a movie called Troll Hunter, and it's a Norwegian movie, so it may be more difficult to get your hands on, but hopefully you will persist in doing so. And I make this, it's not a recommendation, but I put this up as the next thing that we're going to talk about, despite not having ever seen this movie, on the recommendation of Tom Secker, who I will, of course, be meeting next week in France. So if you don't like it, or if it turns out to be a dud, well, don't blame me. Blame Tom. His entire reputation will be riding on this recommendation, so we'll hold him to that. At any rate, that's going to be the next movie that's going to be up on the chopping block for Film Literature in the New World Order. That'll be the third Monday in December, so I hope you will all be ready and prepared for then. As always, all the show notes will be linked up in this on the website at CorbettReport.com, so you can check there for everything we talked about today and a link to information about Troll Hunter for next month. So that's going to do it for today, and I really hope I'm going to be able to put together that JFK podcast before I leave for France, and if so, you can look forward to that popping up on the website this weekend. That's it for me. James Corbett, CorbettReport.com. Thanks for listening.